Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A nationwide 19-day prison strike ended on September 9. Tactics included hunger strikes and work stoppages, while prisoners across the country demanded better labor practices, more rehabilitation programs, and increased access to education behind bars, among other things. Joining us by phone is Director of the Prisons and Justice Initiative at Georgetown University, Mark Howard. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Anne.
Columbus Dispatch senior reporter Randy Ludlow covers prison issues in Ohio. He joins us by phone as well. Welcome back, Randy.
Good morning, Anne.
The Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections declined our invitation to join the show. Sorry to miss him, but Randy Ludlow, can you give us a sense about what happened in Ohio in regard to this nationwide event?
Well, according to Ohio prison officials, there appeared to be little to no participation in a hunger or work strike in protest of conditions or low wages in Ohio prisons.
So there were no inside the prison protests or hunger strikes or anything like that, right?
Well, at least that's according to prison officials, and it's kind of hard to get to the actual prisoners to verify that, but that's what they say on the record.
What about outside the prisons? What kind of activities were there?
Well, I really didn't note anything organized. Obviously, the biggest incident we've had out of prisons during that time period was down at the Ross County prison, where somehow some fentanyl found its way into the prison system, and several employees were taken to the hospital as precaution. An inmate was hospitalized. That is the most newsworthy thing coming out of Ohio prisons during that time period.
Mark Howard, does that surprise you? I mean, does Ohio have a pretty good record on these scores with inmates?
No, I couldn't really speak with authority about Ohio specifically. I think it does have a good reputation in terms of rehabilitative programming that's better than average compared to other parts of the country, but that average is extraordinarily low. So I'd say Ohio has a good reputation, but I couldn't really assess it myself.
Well, let's talk about what some of the inmates do in prisons that they're protesting regarding their treatment. Randy Ludlow, how are inmates employed in Ohio prisons these days?
Well, the prison systems has a what they call Ohio Penal Industries, which is where inmates work within prison on several jobs, ranging, of course, from the stereotypical making of your license plates to they make furniture and other products that are then sold. There's also provision in state law that a preference, at least in state bidding for certain stuff, gives a preference to prison penal industries for purchases. Now, of course, these jobs pay extraordinarily low wages. Inmate wages are set by rule in the Ohio Administrative Code. These are rules approved by a panel of lawmakers. They range from $3 a month for inmates who do no work and simply just behave and keep their cells clean, to $6 to $9 a month for part-time work, while most full-time workers are in the range of $12 to $22 per month. Of course, that is astonishingly little, of course.
Of course, I pay a lot more for a license plate than that. Where does all the revenue go then in Ohio?
You mean as far as from the penal industries?
Yes.
That goes to the prison systems to help fund its operations. And obviously, it's one of the more expensive agencies in state government at a cost of nearly $1.8 billion a year. The prison systems have 12,000 employees, 27 prisons with over $49,000 inmates, and Ohio taxpayers, each prisoner costs them $72 a day to keep behind bars.
Mark Howard, what is the rationale historically for prison or for inmate labor?
Well, I mean, in theory, one rationale is to keep people productive, give them something to do, prepare them for reentry, give them job training. I think, frankly, that's mainly just lip service that's made. The real motivation, and this goes back historically as well, has been profit, has been to benefit from the exploitation of people who have no rights. As you probably know, and many of your listeners hopefully know, the 13th Amendment, which ended slavery, has a very clear exception, which is except for people duly convicted of a criminal offense. And when that happens, all rights are lost. And so in some states in the U.S., people have to work when they're incarcerated for zero pay, and that literally is slave labor. In other cases, not everybody gets to work, and they can be waiting lists and so on for jobs, and they'll get paid, but it's extremely little, as Randy was just saying. We go, some cases, as little as 10 cents an hour up to 25 cents an hour. A high-paying job is about $2 a day for a full day's work. And meanwhile, they're doing real work, and real products are being made and sold, and somebody's profiting from the labor that the incarcerated people are putting in.
We have a report that Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, which helped with the strike, said that there was a hunger strike in Toledo and brief work stoppages in Youngstown. Randy Ludlow, had you heard about any of that?
Since those prisons fall outside of the area we generally cover, no, I had not heard of anything at those institutions.
When this legislative committee that sets these low wages, how often do they meet, Randy?
Well, this is the legislative committee that approves administrative rules for agencies, and this work pay for inmates appears to have been updated, I would assume increased, as of April. But again, DRC contends that these wages may be low, but they say a lot of these result in inmates obtaining a job skill when they depart, so that decreases recidivism and helps keep them off the streets. Whether it ranges from, you know, people emerge work in the prison barber shops and emerge with their barber licenses or their salon licenses. I know I talked to Gary Moore, the director, a couple of weeks ago when he retired, and he was talking, they even have a program at one prison where they have big rigs, semis within the prison, and they're training inmates how to operate these trucks so they can emerge with a commercial driver license to be a truck driver when they're released. So they believe they are beyond money. They are endowing inmates with some job skills that will serve them on the outside.
But Gary Moore also said that we need to do a better job, the state needs to do a better job at rehabilitation to reduce recidivism.
Yes, I mean, Gary thinks we put too many people behind bars, and obviously that is behind part of what's on issue one on the fall ballot, to essentially effectively decriminalize many simple drug possession charges to make them misdemeanors. The first two offenses, at least, would not send you to prison. Director Moore pointed out that nearly 15% of people admitted to Ohio prisons on an annual basis are there on drug possession charges.
And that would largely end with the new thing. Yeah, Mark Howard?
Yeah, I wanted to add, I've met Gary Moore, and I have deep respect for the work that he's done in the state of Ohio, because I think he truly understands something that few people in corrections unfortunately look at, which is the bigger picture, which is that 95% of people who are behind bars will be coming home. And so we need to ask ourselves, even though there might be temptations to say, just lock them up and throw away the key and let's just warehouse them and they don't deserve anything and so on. I don't share that view, but I know that many people have that view. But even just in a self-interested, instrumental, rational way, we want those people, when they come out, to be prepared to reenter society successfully, to have and hold jobs, to be safe for their communities, to be role models and leaders in their communities. And I think Gary Moore gets that and has been pushing for increased rehabilitation and programs and work training and job skill development. And I think more states need to be doing that. I think Ohio has been a leader in that respect. I think Ohio needs to do more, and certainly other states in the country need to do more. But that's really critical, because ultimately we're not doing ourselves any good if we're spending, you know, close to $50,000 a year per person who's incarcerated, and all they're doing is just sitting around watching TV, getting zoned out. And then they come back out and we say, oh, recidivism is high, that's a problem. We can actually change recidivism by improving and increasing programming education is something that I'm very, very closely involved in, and I'm on a weekly, sometimes several times a week, within jails and prisons running education programs, and it has a tremendous impact on changing people's lives and improving society. And I think we all need to think about it that way. Everybody will be coming home. Most people will be coming home. And don't we want them to be safe and productive citizens? And if so, let's do all we can to make that happen.
You know, Ohio, as you say, is a leader in this. But Randy Ludlow, you and I know and go back to the 90s when it was the three strikes and you're out, when they were taking away education benefits, when they were removing, you know, eliminating Pell Grants for inmates. Ohio was a leader back then, too, right?
Well, I mean, you look back then, you know, you describe it, three strikes, you're out.
Everybody was running for sheriff back then, I guess.
Right.
A big law and order.
Right. Determinant sentencing, which removed a lot of the sentencing discretion from judges to tailor a sentence they felt was appropriate. They had no choice but to stick them with a random number of, assigned by the lawmakers. And a lot of, obviously, we hear a lot of hue and cry now for criminal justice reform, that there needs to be a different look at how we handle people, particularly amid the opioid epidemic and the addiction crisis, and where those people are best served. And everybody will contend, of course, it's not state prison, but rather local programs. But again, it's a matter of funding. Education, I think, has reemerged in Ohio, at least. Pretty much everybody is required, if they don't have one, to work toward their high school degree. There are also college classes available, of course, through correspondence, and some taught on premises in Ohio.
But funding, Mark Howard, has decreased a lot since the 80s when it comes to higher ed.
Absolutely. It's essentially disappeared. All funding comes from either philanthropy or independent programs and nonprofits that themselves invest in it. There's almost zero participation by states and by prison officials in terms of supporting the programming financially. But I can live with that as long as they allow the program to come in, because fortunately there is support from society, particularly over the last 5 or 10 years, that's been building for programming. And if they can allow these programs to grow and to thrive, then we're going to have positive results and it'll pay off. I would like to see states recognize it and actually put it into their budget, but I realize we're not quite there yet. But at least open the doors and allow the programs to exist and to flourish.
What states are, what do you, Mark Howard, list as the worst states in the country when it comes to these issues?
Well, frankly, the Deep South spends, you know, very little money on incarceration, absolutely nothing on programming, and tends to warehouse. Now, I'm obviously generalizing because there are exceptions. Texas has been actually a leader nationally in terms of decarceration. Incarceration rates have dropped by 25% in the last 10 years or so. But, you know, there are a number of states that are still living as if it's the 1980s, 1990s. You know, in the 1990s, we were building a new prison every 10 days in this country. The incarceration rate was just skyrocketing. We lock up close to 10 times more people per capita than any other advanced democracy in the world. We have a mass incarceration crisis. We need to do something about it. Fortunately, there has been some leaders. Texas, as I mentioned, California, New York, New Jersey. There's some other states here and there that also have been dropping their incarceration rates with no increase in crime. And I want to highlight that. If you're smart about decarceration, it doesn't bring about an increase in crime. There's a myth that's out there that somehow everyone's going to go right out and start committing crimes. That's false. So you can save money, you can make society safer and your community safer, and you can treat people in a humane way. Because the people who are locked up, I think that sometimes outsiders tend to just think, oh, they're bad people, they're evil people. You know, they're people like us. They're people like our brothers and sisters and cousins who have made mistakes, who have had challenges. Some have done things that are worse than others and deserve to pay a steeper price than others. But we need to start ththinking about them as us, as part of us, as part of our society and our community and our family.
Go ahead, Randy.
I was just going to say, I think there's a fear on the public's part that less time equals more crimes, but that is totally incorrect. Case in point, Michigan adopted sweeping prison sentencing reforms in 2006, and its prison population dropped from 51,000 to 39,000, while its violent crime rate dropped more in Ohio. So, yeah. Mm.
And a lot of examples like that.
And refresh us, I remember before I let you go, Randy Ludlow, how many people are incarcerated in Ohio now?
Well, we've dropped a couple of thousand due to concerted efforts to divert nonviolent low-level felons to local programs or in state prisons. But right now, we're just a little over 49,000. Mm-hmm. But I would point, when Gary Moore started, our director of state prisons, who just retired, started as a teacher's aide in 1974 at $2.64 an hour, talk about low wages. Ohio's prisons help 8,300 inmates. Now we have six times as many.
Randy Ludlow, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ann.
It's Randy Ludlow. He's a senior reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. We want to hear from our listeners. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let us know what you think about the kinds of rights that inmates should have in our public prisons. You can, and we'd love to hear from former inmates as well about what it's like behind bars and what they'd like to see change for the future. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. September 9th marked the final day of a 19-day prison strike that involved inmates from across the country. Some stopped work, others went on hunger strikes. They called for better labor conditions, more rehabilitation programs, and increased access to education, among other things. Still with us by phone, Director of Prisons and Justice Initiative at Georgetown University, Mark Howard. Mark, thanks again for joining us.
Sure.
Also joining us by phone is David Singleton. He's executive director and attorney for the Ohio Justice and Policy Center. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you, Ann. Happy to be here.
And just want to remind our listeners that the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections declined our invitation to join the show. David, what do you know about what impact the strike had or didn't have in Ohio?
Well, there were some prisoners who participated, I know, at Toledo Correctional Institution. And so I think that's just a good thing, that at least there were some Ohio prisoners taking part of this protest. Part of what is so difficult is that prison conditions, it's like they're put in a black box. No one in the public really knows what's happening in prisons. And until we get people speaking out who are actually incarcerated, who can shed light on what the conditions are and how dehumanizing they are, nothing will change. So I'm glad that there were at least some voices in Ohio, incarcerated voices, speaking out and joining this protest.
Gary Moore, who just left as head of Ohio prisons, just retired, it was very well thought of. A lot of people thought he made great strides in improving conditions and improving prospects for lowering recidivism during his watch.
I have the utmost respect for Gary, and I think it's a loss, generally speaking, for our prison system for Gary not to be leading it anymore. That said, the problems of conditions are the problems existed before Gary Moore. They're going to continue until we get a broader segment of the community saying that enough's enough. There are serious problems with the health care that prisoners get in Ohio. There are problems in terms of violence. Prisons are overcrowded in Ohio, just like they are across the country. And that's one of the reasons why it is so difficult to adequately fund rehabilitative services. And if we had fewer people that we locked up, then we'd be able to have better conditions. So the overcrowding of our prison system statewide and obviously nationally as well is part of what are driving these problems. And And just on that one point, there are lots of lower level nonviolent folks taking up beds in prisons. And we've got to do something about that. But we also have to do something about the virtually life sentences that people are getting when they could be home. I mean, locking somebody up for 50 years when they did something as a teenager and they are just warehoused is not smart. It's not just. And we've got to not only make sure that we are doing something about nonviolent, low-level drug offenders and getting them out of prison, but also folks who are serving really, really long sentences who don't need to be behind bars anymore.
And that's largely a function of the whole three strikes and you're out thing from the 90s.
Well, in some states that is definitely true, but also, you know, in Ohio, it's just a function of the politics of crime and wanting to lock someone up virtually forever because of a violent crime where they can be rehabilitated, they can age out of crime, and we ought not to be locking people up forever. And we ought to believe in the possibility and promise of redemption.
Yeah, Mark Howard?
Yeah, if I could jump in here, I agree completely with David. I think that certainly the three strikes laws are indefensible, monstrous, and just totally irrational. I mean, you have people who get life without parole for writing three bad checks, you know, totaling $131 or stealing a golf club as a third offense. I mean, those are just patently beyond the pale. But I'd like to go much further along with David, which is to say there are people who've done bad things and they were dangerous for a time. They needed to be off the street, but they are not forever defined by the way they once were, often decades earlier. I teach in prisons, and I've been doing it for 4 years, maximum security. I've been around some people who decades earlier were a completely different person, and now they've transformed through programming, through education, and they're prepared to return to society. And we need to at some point say enough is enough and give people a chance when people are ready to return and they're safe. Otherwise, why not just give everybody life sentences? I mean, that's effectively what we're doing, in the sense of that people serving so much time that they have so little hope of actually coming home. I think if we're to have a meaningful parole system, if we're to believe in rehabilitation, if we're to believe in the possibility of human transformation, we need to act on that. I'm seeing it with my own eyes and the people that I'm encountering in prison who talk to me about how they used to be. They're not proud of it. They're ashamed of it, but they're proud of what they're doing today. Okay, and we need to give them that chance and to be ready to help them along the way to successful reentry, because they will succeed. They have succeeded when they've done so.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. In the wake of the 19-day prison strike and hunger strike across the country, in prisons calling for more, lots of improvements to the conditions of prisons and prison policies, an end to what is termed prison slavery, also a rescinding discernment of the Prison Litigation Reform Act, among many other things. We're talking about what's going on in Ohio and across the country. You just heard from Mark Howard. He's director of the Prisons and Justice Initiative at Georgetown University. And also with us, David Singleton. He's executive director and attorney for the Ohio Justice and Policy Center. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Kate in Dublin, you're on the air. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment is, unfortunately, we had a young family member incarcerated, and we found out the hard way that businesses profit on prisoners and their families while they're in prison.
How so?
If every time the family member would call us, we had to pay for this phone bill, which I understand is fine. Sometimes it was 3 cents a minute. Sometimes it was $4 a minute.
Right.
It just depended on where he was. The family member was in a program in SEPTA, which is in Nelsonville. They were offered the opportunity to work in Carroll, but they had to pay for their own transportation, which was about $25 a day. Again, no chance to make money there, no matter what they're doing. Their commissary privileges. I'm not saying that they need to be eating Little Debbie's every day, but toothpaste should not cost $10 a tube.
Yeah, why is it, David Singleton and Mark Howard maybe? I mean, why these jacked up prices for inmates and their families when it comes to things like everything from toothpaste to phone calls?
Well, it's simple economics for there. It's a monopoly. They set the prices however they want. Their prisons have contracts with individual companies, whether it's for the goods provided in commissary, whether it's for the phone companies, and now video visitation is the new thing, which people think of as prison Skype, but it's anything but. It's super expensive, and it's very poor quality, and there are drop calls, and there are fees, setup fees, and re-up fees, and fees left and right. What we're doing to our own families in terms of how we're robbing them blind, and these are often poor families, families that don't have many resources, is just unimaginable. If people would just stop and think, how would you want your loved one to be treated? Would you want, and we haven't even talked about the violence in prisons, the fear, the sexual violence that takes place. It is so inhumane and torturous what we inflict on our community members and our family members that I think people would just be shocked if they discovered it. And that's why I think it's important to have shows like this to talk about what actually takes place, because it's unconscionable. And I'm sorry, Kate, for what your loved one has to go through and what you as a family have to go through in terms of the costs that are involved. But there's clear exploitation. There's a lot of profit that's being made, not just by the state, but by private companies that are selling the toothpaste and the phone calls and so on.
Kate, thanks a lot for that call. David?
Yeah, I also would say to Kate, I feel for your loved one. I feel for you and your family. And one of the things that I think people ignore is that when families and when incarcerated people are basically being gouged, there are fewer resources available for them, their personal resources, when they come home. Often, and people don't understand this, but in Ohio, you get, if you're released, you get a $75 gate money, and that's it. And if you haven't,
that
been
means
able,
when you walk out of prison, you get $75.
You get $75, and you know if you have social support and a family that with means, you'll be okay. But that's not going to be the case for most people coming out of prison. Imagine if you were able to actually be paid a wage, a living wage in prison, and save money so that when you come home, you're able to better get on your feet and be productive. I mean, we care about recidivism, but we don't seem to care as much about the making sure that we put people in the best possible position to succeed when they come home. And gouging them when they're locked up and taking money from their families in these ways is not going to help ultimately with the recidivism problem.
Mark in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Hi, yes. Good morning, everyone. Hey, I used to work at the Department of Corrections here in Ohio for approximately 5 years, and one of the concerns that I have is the implicit bias, racial and religious biases that go on within Ohio Department of Corrections.
How so?
Staff, the leadership within the prison context, taking liberty to call, in particular, African-American inmates inward and trying to advocate for change. You know, when I was involved with the prison system, it didn't happen. It seemed like it's an okay thing to do that because the word is, this is prison. I'm trying to understand that concept as it applies to race and religious preferences that inmates have. And there's no accountability for staff once when they call individuals N-words and other things that's not part of their ID. I had trouble with that. And I saw due respect from Director Moore and other leadership, but they seem to be really quiet about those particular issues within the prison context, that is race and religious bias.
Well,
I'll take my comments.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate the call. Wow. I mean, Mark Howard, that just seems so anathema to what we're trying to achieve. But on the other hand, it probably seems like a small thing. Someone's not getting beat up or raped. So what's a word?
Well, I think the racial bias is clear, and it goes throughout our criminal justice system. I actually have an op-ed in today's Washington Post on that very topic. But, you know, in terms of people of color being arrested or being charged or being sentenced.
It's all disproportionate.
When they're in prison, the treatment sent to solitary confinement, there's clear research showing African-Americans much more likely to be sent, denied parole later. I mean, the racial bias, and I'm glad that Mark brought that up in the call, because you can't have a conversation about criminal justice in prisons without talking about racial bias. It's throughout our system. It's at the core of our system, and it's part of the fundamental problem with our system, and it needs to be addressed. And I'm sorry to hear that he witnessed this experience firsthand as someone working in corrections, but I'm not at all surprised because it happens every day.
Mark said something that I think, if I could just jump in,
it's
really important, and that is that there's no accountability. I know that from the cases that I have handled where there have been complaints that the people I represent have filed. They are not taken seriously. It is, you know, if there is the word of an incarcerated person against the word of a staff member, the staff member 99 times out of 100, actually probably 999 times out of 1,000 is going to be believed over the incarcerated person. And it is so frustrating. That's where it goes back to that point about feeling like we're in a black box where the truth just doesn't get out. And you can be absolutely telling the truth if you are a prisoner about being called the N-word. You could be telling the truth about an assault that a staff member perpetrated against you. Mm. And good luck persuading those people in power in the system to hold the wrongdoer accountable. It is an uphill battle.
I wanted to bring up another issue before I know Mark Howard has to go, but I wanted to bring up another issue, and that is what we pay and how we train our the people who work in prisons, maybe the directors or the wardens and the social, you know, some people are higher paid, the psychiatrists, the psychologists, but the people who are on the front line, they aren't necessarily very well trained or very high paid in general. Is that true across the board, Mark Howard?
Yes, absolutely. That said, I'm not sure if the solution is simply just pay them more, because it's coming from a very finite, limited budget where I think there are tremendous priorities in terms of programming for the people who are affected by it, who are actually incarcerated. But that said, you know, if you had a plan and said, we need to decarcerate, we need to take out, I think, up to 50% of the prison population does not belong there and should be there for a much shorter period of time. With that savings, you could suddenly have much more humane prisons. You could pay staff more. You could have them be better trained. You could give them implicit bias training. You can give them psychology training. I mean, in Germany, it takes 2 years to become a prison guard.
Right.
And the training you get is essentially the same training as to become a social worker and social psychologist. In this country, it's often 6 weeks, and you get a very low-paying job, and you have people who are in high-stress environments who are not prepared, and they react with force and domination. And that's not the way to go. But there is a better way to go. And that's something, as I leave the show, I'd like to recommend in my book, Unusually Cruel, Prisons, Punishment, and the Real American Exceptionalism, where I compare the U.S. to other countries and show that there actually are better models for criminal justice in prisons. And I hope that some of your listeners will be interested in reading it.
Mark Howard, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it, too.
Mark Howard, director of the Prisons and Justice Initiative at Georgetown University, will continue our conversation. We'll get to the calls. Thanks, everybody, for your participation today. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. More than 2 million people were incarcerated in the United States by the end of 2016. That's the latest date we have. Where you are in prison determines a lot about how you live, because civil rights, inmate wages, and rehabilitation programs vary widely among the states. Those disparities stoked a 19-day inmate strike that ended on September 9th. The strike involved work stoppages, hunger strikes, and more. Atop of the list of demands from prisoners was an end to what they call prison slavery. That is a no or very low pay for work that may be mandatory, maybe not. Still with us by phone is Executive Director and Attorney for Ohio Justice and Policy Center, David Singleton. David, thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
And joining us by phone, former Ohio inmate Ronnie Hopkins. Hi, Ronnie.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm good. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Buckeye Institute legal fellow Daniel Dew works to reduce Ohio's prison population with investments in police and mental health care. He joins us as well now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Daniel, you work on the Ohio Justice Reinvestment Ad Hoc Committee. What is that, and how much of your conversation center around, you know, the idea of work and rehabilitation?
Well, right now, the committee is really focused on what data do we have? What information do we have? How can we make these improvements? And so there's been a lot of presentations about policing and local policing, police involvement in the community, investment in mental health and addiction issues, so that we're not sending people who are suffering from addiction and mental health issues to prison when they would be better helped in the community. So that's been the focus thus far on the JRI committee.
You know, I have to say, I've been hearing that, not from you, but I've been hearing this for years now, that we know that mental health plays such a large role in this, that we know that drug addiction, which is a completely different animal than a lot of things, is playing such a big role in this. But nothing ever seems to change.
You're right. We've done some things around the edges. We did House Bill 86 in 2011, which did a lot to put people on probation instead of sending them to prison. We did targeted community alternatives to prison in the last budget. But there can be more. There's more to be done. And I think a lot of the problem is that we have a hard time distinguishing between those people who are suffering from mental health issues and who are suffering from addiction from those people who are intentionally doing wrong things, or in the case of addiction, there's really a really hard line to distinguish between traffickers and users. A lot of times people sell to support their habit, or
right.
Under Ohio law, you don't even have to sell drugs to be a trafficker. If you share some with a loved one or a friend, under Ohio law, you are a trafficker. So it's really difficult to make those distinctions.
Ronnie Hopkins, tell us, give us a thumbnail of your experience, why you're in prison, how long you were there, and what your story is.
Okay, so I did 3 years mandatory prison term in Grafton Reintegration Center for manufacturing methamphetamines. When I was younger, I made a lot of poor choices. I lost my mom at the age of 15, and I used that as an excuse to kind of fuel this reckless behavior that just led to a downward spiral of addiction and then manufacturing to support my habit. And when I got arrested, when I got charged with this, I immediately knew that I needed to change my life. And for me, it was an experience with Jesus that changed my life. And he used education once I got to prison to change my life. So as soon as I got there, I enrolled into GED classes and I started studying every day. Because to me, it was, if I did this to myself, if I took myself away from my family, and if I got locked up for 3 years and I didn't come out better, then I didn't deserve a second chance, right? So for me, it was immediately work to get better, and Jesus used education for me to do that, right? So I started studying every day, and I passed my GED test on the first try. And not only did I pass, but I scored higher than my teacher had ever seen in the math section of the test. So I immediately signed up for college classes, and I started taking college classes, and I was able to utilize technology that was provided by JPay. They had these tablets that allowed us to take college classes in the prison.
Where were you incarcerated, Ronnie?
In the state of Ohio, Grafton Correctional Reintegration Center. So we had the opportunity to take education, and that was where I really focused my life because I had no education when I got incarcerated, when I got locked up. I had chosen my whole life to just feel sorry for myself, and I just used this as an excuse to just further dig a hole for myself.
I knew
that education could change that.
I'm just taking a wild guess here. Not really wild. It's an informed guess. David Singleton, that Ronnie's story is pretty familiar.
Ronnie, first of all, congratulations to you for being out and for what you've accomplished. And
your story
is very moving. It really
is.
And I hope that you will continue to make your voice heard as a leader in the criminal justice reform movement. And yes, your story and Ronnie's story is very familiar. There are so many people who, with potential, who, if they're only seen as the human beings they are, would be given a chance. And that is what I think too few people in the community appreciate, is that we are talking about human beings who are locked up, human beings who have potential, human beings who are 98% of them are going to come home one day. They're not going to spend the rest of their lives locked up, and they're going to be our neighbors. And we need to care about the opportunities that they have available to them while they are locked up so that they can become the good members of the community that we need them to be and want them to be.
Ronnie, did you work while you were in prison?
I did not. See, in the state of Ohio, if you are classed as education, which, again, was what I devoted my incarceration to, was my faith and my education. So if you're classed as a student, you don't have to go do any of these jobs that, you know, that other people are given. So if you sign up for education and you maintain a certain level of attendance to your educational programs, then that is your job, and you still receive the same pay that anybody else gets, and they don't make you take any of the other jobs. So if you are committed to your education, which I was, then again, you don't have to be classed as porter or, you know, outside job detail or anything like that. So because I was a student, I was able to really just, I'm still enrolled in college right now. So I'm still working on my college degree through Lantern and JPay and Ashland University right now. So these things kind of transferred to where I'm at right now, and I'm still working on these things.
It's
so,
a real thing,
And that's just the thing, is a lot of people don't really realize that this translates to real life. And this education that God has opened up to me through JPay and Ashland University is really changing my life.
I wanted to turn to Dee in Columbus. Dee, you're a former prison system worker?
Yes. I mean, I was incarcerated in another state, and I've worked in the so-called industries. And, you know, the pay is very minimal. And the majority of the times people take those jobs because they are the better paying job, and you don't want to be a burden on your family. And, you know, a lot of the things, I spent a lengthy amount of time, and here's the reason I don't want to give out my name is because, you know, people know you, and it's still hard. I've been I've been like 28 years.
But there's still stigma.
Yeah, exactly. And I've been out for 8 years. But I was fortunate enough, you know, to have a strong family support and wife.
Mm-hmm.
But still to this day, you know, you try to apply for jobs. I give you a case in point. I applied to Chase Bank, and I got the interview and was offered the job. But, you know, they said, well, it's up to corporate. So, I mean, there's still a lot of barriers.
You got bumped at that point. You qualified.
Yeah,
exactly. They liked you and you got bumped.
But
yeah,
because of the conviction, I mean, it still makes it difficult. And when I originally went into the system, they had all these programs. They had colleges. And I was in college. I obtained associate degrees, and I was two semesters shy of getting a bachelor's degree, and they pulled these programs out.
Mm-hmm.
And the prisons, in my opinion, are not geared to make people to become out and be successful law-abiding citizens. I mean,
I don't want to cut you off, but I do want to get some feedback from the folks we have with us, and I thank you so much for your call. So, Daniel Dew, are these topics that you're talking about in the committee that you're working on?
These are things that I hope the committee focuses on. One of the worst things that we do as a society is we kind of throw people away. Even when we offer them these education programs, which are great. I mean, even conservative studies say that for every dollar we invest in education in prison, we save $2 in recidivism costs. So those are great. But unfortunately, we put up so many barriers to people as they're coming out of prison, either through occupational licensing. And I'll give a shout out to David's organization. They've done a great job compiling a list of all the barriers to employment with occupational licensing.
They get to learn how to become a barber, but I don't know if those are still there, David Singleton, but they're banned from getting a barber's license if they have a felon on the record.
Oh, they're very much still there.
That's just crazy town. Okay. Yeah, go ahead, Daniel Dew.
It is. And then the other thing that we do is we, a lot of businesses will automatically just, you know, not hire somebody
right.
or even interview somebody because they have a felony on their record. And we keep those. It becomes a lifelong scarlet letter for them. And so we can do things, you know, businesses need to do things, need to reevaluate whether they can hire formerly incarcerated people. We can do things to seal people's records so that they don't have to disclose those things on job applications. There's a number of things that we can do beyond prison so that when they come out, that not only are they prepared, but they actually have opportunities. Mm-hmm. I can't even imagine how discouraging it must be for people who come out who have invested all this time and energy in getting education and then are blocked because of society and because of the legal barriers that we place in front of them.
Ronnie Hopkins, what are you getting a degree in? Is it something that you know that you'll have actually have opportunities in when you're out?
Right now, my associate's degree will be in general studies, and then I will also have the opportunity to kind of move on and continue in an education. So a lot of the prereqs are taken care of. And the best part of this whole thing is that the program that Ashland University and JPay offered me was that my associate's degree is being paid for even upon my release, right? So because of certain criteria that I met while I was incarcerated, mm-hmm. Now I am at home, again, using the Lantern and the JPay system to continue online classes through Ashland University.
So they incentivize you to do well.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I made the dean's list.
Well, what do you want to get a degree in? Tell me what you're shooting for.
Well, communications is something that's really interesting to me. I like public speaking. I have a motivational page called GetItGoing.life on Facebook where we do motivational speaking. I speak at my church every week. I'm the youth director at my church. I would love to be able to speak and continue to tell the story of hope so that people have hope when they're coming out of these situations or going into these situations.
Ronnie, we're going to post a link to your website and our website at WOSU.org. I want to thank you for joining us, Ronnie Hopkins, former inmate in Ohio prisons. Thank you so much for joining us. Also, David Singleton, Executive Director and Attorney for Ohio Justice and Policy Center. Thanks to you. And Daniel Dew, Legal Fellow at Buckeye Institute. Thanks to you.
Thanks for having me.
There's a lot more. You bet. There's a lot more to talk about. We'll continue our conversation if you stay with us over time. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.